Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk to Dr. Masheed Ansari. You're most welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam, Brother Paul. It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you on the channel. You're, of course, in Australia at the moment, so it's evening time where you are, and it's morning time here in the UK.
That's right, Sydney, Australia. So, g'day from Australia.
Wonderful. G'day from London. Dr. Ansari is an author and a senior lecturer in Islamic studies at Charles Sturt University, which is Australia's largest regional university. She's the author of a critically acclaimed book titled Modern Debates on Prophecy and Prophethood in Islam, Muhammad Iqbal and Said Nursi. And this was published last year by the very prestigious publishers Routledge. One reviewer helpfully summarized the book as follows. While prophethood is the backbone of the Islamic tradition and an uncompromised tenet of faith, the impact of modernity with its ambivalent status afforded to the prophet and institution of prophethood shook many Muslim scholars. Through analysis of these modern debates on prophethood in Islam, this book situates Muhammad Iqbal's and Said Nursi's discourses within it and assesses their implications on the modern period. This book introduces the what, who, and how of the prophets in the Islamic tradition, end quote. So I guess my first question, if I may, is why did you choose prophethood as a subject of your book? And can you tell us about your choice of Iqbal and Nursi? Why did you choose and focus on them, really, rather than so many others you might have done?
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you, Paul. I guess prophethood is for personal reasons, of course, but there's also academic reasons for this choice of study. Prophecy and prophethood is the second tenet in Islamic creedal faith, if you like. You know, in the Shahada, we say there is no God but Allah, and the Prophet Muhammad is the messenger of God. So messengerhood and Nabuwa is part and parcel of the beginning of faith, if you like. The middle and the end of faith. So looking at faith, the Islamic tradition in its totality, you cannot ignore prophethood. And also I think I felt like there was a gap. There were so many books out there on Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which rightfully so, and so many that are coming out right now as well. In terms of its theological contributions, I found that there were less, that there could be more in this space. For me, at a personal level, understanding Prophet Muhammad was something that, as a young person, I was motivated and had a sort of a dream with at a time when I had very little access to knowledge in Sydney here in Australia. And so it sort of became an answer to my prayer, if you like, or a dream that I had, that I was able to actually write a book on Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So it was a fulfillment of so many things. But from a perspective of its significance as a topic, I think today we're so obsessed about Islam and studying Islamic studies and Muslims sociologically, you know, political Islam, you know, Islam and economics, which are all important areas, not to be, diminished. However, I think beyond and above those, I think understanding why Muslims are motivated in terms of how they understand faith and God, their relationship with God, and essentially their practice, I think the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his role in this cannot be ignored. So I felt like this is an important topic, and especially like as we go a little bit deeper into the book and some of the chapters that I talk about, in the modern era, actually became, I suppose, problematic again. Some of the issues related to prophecy and prophet good. So I felt like it needed attention from the modern scholars.
And why did you choose Iqbal and Nursi specifically amongst so many others?
Yes. So I felt like the choice for Muhammad Iqbal, South Indian at that time, you know, Pakistan was not established, though he was very much for it. But, you know, such a significant personality and scholar there. You know, he's a poet philosopher, as he's celebrated and well known for. I wanted to intentionally pick two very different geographies. I felt like somewhat there's two arguments there at academic level. I felt so sometimes the Muslim world is so far and vast, you know, culturally, linguistically, and I wanted to be inclusive of the scholarship and to show the diversity in that. So I intentionally picked somebody from, you know, the South Indian continent and also Anatolia, which are the former Ottoman Empire, which was Said Nursi.
So just to clarify that Iqbal's date, 1877, is when he was born, and he died in 1938, and this is obviously before Pakistan came into existence.
Correct.
Just mention his dates. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but he was, as you know, and I think this is one of his contributions was he was in the British colonial era. He was born in that period. But he obviously had a different vision politically and for Islam, Islamic revival. So he wrote his famous Reconstruction of Islam, the essays that he delivered, and they were published as a book. And he's
still read today. You can still get them on Amazon in English. I know some brothers were encouraging me to buy a copy recently. So
it's time to get the world talking about Black-led brands. We all have our favorites, our ride or dies, and the ones we can count on to help us live out our best lives. But we can't keep them all to ourselves. So if you're feeling like Black Opal Beauty, tell somebody. If the lip bar gives you a lip for every drip, let them know. And if your hair is doing the do, shout that out too. Because one shout out leads to another, and almost half of Black-led brands are discovered by word of mouth. Join Walmart in shouting out your favorite Black-led products, creating a new world of choices at walmart.com/blackandunlimited.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
His influence is very enduring and present with us today, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's also quite well known in Europe. He's obviously he was educated in the English language. He went to schools in the colonial era there, and he also studied abroad. He was studying in Europe. He was there in England, of course, as well. He sat for the bar there, so he had a legal background, and I personally relate to him at that level because I also have a background in law.
Interesting.
Yeah, I somewhat teach sometimes. Do some teaching in legal studies as well here in Australia. But yes, he's well known in Germany in particular. He did his PhD there. He was very much fond of German literature and the philosophers, and he's quite well versed in them. And I believe they've named a street after him, and, you know, they've got a plaque and in different particular cities. I did a presentation once in the university there in Germany, and we had a lot of interest from that community. So Iqbal has a different important, and I think both Iqbal and Nursi born around almost the same date or year.
Same year. Both born in the same year, weren't they? 1877, I think.
Yeah. There's, you know, some different opinions about the exact date of Nursi's birth. There's some discussion around that in terms of in the scholarship, but I mean, more or less the same time period. And I wanted to create a dialogue, a discourse, and bring them into a discussion. As ambitious as that was, I felt that necessary that as Muslims we look at the Islamic scholarship to understand how Muslim scholars and individuals responded to modernity and to colonization also. So I think to really, and they were different. And when you look at their lives, they were different contexts. They had different educational upbringing, etc. And also even methodology and approach. You know, Nursi is more, you know, from eastern part of Anatolia, you know, from the periphery of the Ottoman Empire. He was a Kurdish scholar, well known in Turkey, but also he has a very conflicted role in the Turkish Republic. You know, he was also somewhat controversial as well in that country. But again, great towering figure, great contribution to the field of Islamic theology in particular.
So another question might be, just to come back to the first part of this about prophethood. How do we apply the prophet sunnah in our time? I mean, I think you mentioned, and you're very passionate about social justice and the rights of the oppressed, and you're very concerned about Islamophobia, I think, in your native country, in Australia. But how do we apply the prophet sunnah in our time, in the light of what you said about Iqbal and Nursi as well?
That's a great question. I think when we look at the works of Iqbal and both Nursi and their project of Islamic revivalism, we get the clues and answers to this question. So I'm going to give a bit of a longer answer. Please feel free to interrupt me. But I think that they, in their project of Islamic revivalism, you know, Iqbal calls it reconstruction, Nursi calls it like at the Tajdidi style, is you know, faith-based sort of revival. I think there were these elements of spiritual revival, which I think the prophet was at the center of, that, you know, he sought to create revival spiritually, faith and theology based, but also politically. I mean, both of them had different approaches. For Iqbal, this was a key issue, key aspect of his revival. He felt that he was seeing the turmoil around in the Muslim world, including in India, you know, being under British rule for so long. And he wanted to see an independent Muslim state. So I think the key is their approach to how they understood the Prophet, peace be upon him, and how they try to kind of find answers to their own regional context. And for Iqbal, it was more like, okay, he wanted Muslims to have an independent Muslim state. Post-colonization. I mean, there was sort of like a fascination or a kind of imagination of how a Muslim independent state would look like in a post-colonized context. And that's the vision that Iqbal pushed forward in British India. And but, of course, there was a lot of persecution on both sides, the Muslims and Hindus. We won't go into those details. But he didn't quite live long enough, as you said, 1938, he didn't quite live long enough to see how that state would actually look like. So I wonder how, if he's, you know, I often imagine or think about how Iqbal may have responded or thought of his idea, or if he lived to actually see it.
Because we have formal independence today. Pakistan is formally independent, and India isn't. Numerous Muslim majority countries are officially independent, but many would say that is a technicality, that in reality many of these countries in practice de facto are quite subservient to the dominant power, which of course is the United States and its allies in the West. So true post-colonial reality hasn't really come about. We still have what is your view about, do you think that we have a new kind of colonialism? So we have, you know, Iqbal's vision of a independent Pakistan came to be, but has it really come to be? I know this is very controversial and what's going on in Pakistan, of course, but are we still in a colonial type era, do you think? Has true independence really come about?
I agree with you, Paul. I think it's a question we need to ask and we need to examine. Are we really do we have the independence that we think that we have, or particularly in the nation? Really, Pakistan is an ethno-religious state, quite much like, I mean, I don't want to make false parallels with other such states, but we can see how that can be sometimes problematic. And yeah, and in terms of its politically, whether or economically, how independent it is, that's a really important question to ask, and not necessarily so. And when we look at Turkey and Nursi's case, you know, he lived in the Caliphate era of the Ottomans, towards the end of it, of course. And he's interesting because I know not many people would like to point this out about his biography, but he was somewhat critical of the Ottoman caliphs at one stage, and he, you know, sort of had this dialogue with the caliph and Abdurrahman and approached him because he wanted more reforms in the eastern part of Turkey, of course, because there was some, you know, he thought he was a bit autocratic at one point. So he was very much pro-constitutionalism, Nursi, and even in the Young Turks movement, he was, like Iqbal, he was kind of saying, yeah, let's go for it. Let's see where this will take us. So it looked really ideal, utopian, you know, kind of at that point in history.
At that point, yeah.
Like, it looked like, wow, this could be the solution. But, of course, we know with Nursi that he actually lived through it. He lived through the fall of the empire, and then he lived through the Turkish Republic, and he was actually quite oppressed by it. They offered him actually to be a part of that and an official role. And he, of course, when he saw it and he felt that religion was put in the backside, and this hardcore secularism was pushed forward, he then backtracked and said, no, this is not going to work. And then I think this is what impacted his methodology. So when we compare Iqbal and Nursi, we see that methodologically one is perhaps based more on political Islam, that this might be, you know, a top-down approach. If we get our independence, a nation-state set up, then, you know, Muslim pan-Islamism, this that was floating around as an idea at that time, of course. Whereas Nursi entertained those ideas, like Iqbal, but he sort of pushed back. Particularly, you know, he himself describes his life, Nursi, as the first Sayyid, the old Sayyid and the new Sayyid. In the old Sayyid period, we find Nursi on the battleground defending his country, or jihad, if you like, in the World War I. But we see a very different individual in the second stage of his life. And I think he is in exile. He faces a lot of oppression, and he sees the brutality of the Turkish Republic directly impacting his own life, but also so many Muslims. Like many of the scholars, you know, many of whom face death actually as well. And oppression that, you know, where Quran was outlawed. And so it was really extreme secularism, as you know, in the Turkish Republic, which was quite problematic. And then he, you know, he sort of gave up that, and he said no. His project then became a revivalism, a faith-based revivalism based on Islamic beliefs and also spiritual revival.
Okay, I mean, just for one moment, I'd like just to change the focus, if I may, to your experience as a Muslim in Australia. Because what we're speaking here is globally about the Ummah in Anatolia, in Pakistan, in India, and so on. But Australia is has a very substantial Muslim population, obviously. What are the pressing issues Muslims are experiencing in Australia at the moment? And how does your work on Iqbal and Nursi speak to that today, do you think?
That's a wonderful question. Right now in Australia, we are a slice of the global world map. So whatever the pulse of the globe is right now, we experience it here down under in the southern lands, of course. You know, right now we have the issue of obviously the conflict in the Middle East and the genocide that's taking place in Gaza is having an impact here in Australia. In relation to my work and what I hope to create impact upon is, you know, I have written about, I also write about Muslim history in Australia. That's sort of another area that I focus on. But really, I mean, Muslims in Australia experience Australia was a colonial, obviously a colony of England as well, as you know. And so we had similar sort of problems, Muslims here. Of course, a very different history and context, minority community. And, yeah, so right now Muslims, we had a few incidents here in local incidents in Australian context that have given rise to unfortunately, negative forms of, you know, not just racial, but Islamophobia. You know, so sort
do,
of.
Do you find that the current situation in the Middle East, as you say, the attacks on Gaza? I don't know much about Australian politics, I confess, but am I right? Do I get the sense the Australian government is committed, like British government, European Union, the American government, to the Zionist Israeli state? And this creates a conflict, obviously, with Muslims and others in Australia, because not everyone who supports the Palestinians is Muslim. There are many people who support them for reasons of humanity and human rights and dignity and so on. Is this creating a renewed sense of Islamophobia and conflict within the Australian body politic, government and Muslims and Palestine?
Yeah, so we had I hosted a colloquium just about 2 weeks ago, and we had experts who actually studied, you know, the Islamophobia register that we have here in Australia, and also looking at the media presentation or the lack of objectivity, you know, on the mainstream media, as a research that was conducted by my colleague Dr. Susan Carland and Dr. Daria Inner, and also Professor Scott. So all of them really highlighted the gaps in our system. So the Australian government, yeah, just more or less like England and Canada and all of the, you know, English-speaking countries, very much aligned with America. It was a bit of a shock to the Australians. And I think not just Muslims and Arabs, but also the wider community, quite divided. We had a lot of incidents in the media, et cetera, that sort of created a bit of a rift in society. It's a bit controversial right now because the encampments, the universities are sort of manifesting at Sydney University.
It's happening in Sydney University as well, and your university, yeah?
Sydney University is one of the first and oldest universities here in Australia, and, yes, we have encampments there. We've had, you know, a very strong – we've had a no stop in the protests since the beginning of the war. So it is a very pro-peace and a very large population that would want a ceasefire. And within Parliament, the two major – parties are not really, you know, it's a bit of a controversial area in our politics, and I think things are changing rapidly. The Greens are obviously pro ceasefire, although, you know, Labor is a little bit having a difficult time because this whole question about how Australia is supporting and aiding is very much there, and it hasn't been addressed. We haven't had the response. But Muslim leaders are having a, I think, again, this is where it shows where Muslims need to really be grounded in faith at this time, not just in Australia, but around the globe, which is why I appreciate platforms like yours, because it allows us to reflect on such important ethical and questions that if we're not grounded within our tradition, then, you know, we can sort of lose the compass, so to speak.
The temptation might have been in the past. I think it's perhaps less so now. I could be wrong. Is that Muslim activists just join forces with the political left, just join left-wing causes and use the discourse of Marxism, perhaps, or socialism, or post-Enlightenment human rights discourse. I'm not saying all that is wrong, but nevertheless, that is a discourse that is indigenous to a Western mindset. You obviously Marxism and human rights and so on, you know, whether it be John Locke or J.S. Mill, this comes out of a particular part of the world. It's not indigenous to Islam, which has its own discourse, of course, when it comes to human dignity and the responsibilities of people before God and to their neighbors and to the oppressed and the marginalized. The Quran's very clear on that. Do you sense that the Muslim voice, the Muslim mind, if I can generalize like that, is finding an independence from these other discourses, or is it still very much locked into this left-wing ideological expression of humanity and human rights when it comes to Palestine, especially, if that makes sense?
I definitely see where you're coming from, but I think when we go back to our topic of prophethood and Nabuwa, and we understand the concept that prophets, you know, even in the Quranic portrayal of them, if we were able to see the categories of influence that they had, one of their key roles was to not only propagate faith and belief in God, and but also for social justice. and, you know, ethics and society and on various levels. You know, we see it in the Quran in so many prophets. Like Shu'aib, I think I was reminded earlier today that, you know, he was having a, you know, fighting or seeking justice at the, you know, financial level, and Lut more of a moral and ethical level. So I think this ethos or the ethics of social justice is very much there. It's very prophetic. I think Muslim scholars in Australia and in America and England, I think elsewhere as well, are, I think, understanding that. Some people are, some Muslims are kind of silent on this issue. But I think whether or not we're aligning with the left or the right, I think, I mean, Muslim scholars have talked about that Islam, it's beyond left and right, I suppose.
Exactly. It's very much a European, indeed French kind of paradigm, isn't it? It was just the French Revolution, those who sat on the left of the speaker in the French Assembly, those who sat on the right. So what one group identified with the royalists and the monarchy and the church, the other, of course, were Republicans and anti-royalist power, etc. So this is where the left and right jargon comes from, the French Revolution, ironically. But of course, Islam is not part of the French struggle over crown and altar between monarchy and church. It has its own very different history. So it's an artificial kind of grafting on our own faith, really, if we express our faith in those terms. It transcends it or includes it, but it's not identified with any particular part of the spectrum.
Which is why I think Muslims don't have a problem with on points of social justice or climate justice, environment, you know, to join hand and to support and promote those sorts of avenues of seeking, making things right. You know, again, that's an interpretation of Muslims being a role of khalif on earth. You know, they have a stewardship role towards a protection of the environment. And also when we look at the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his own life, even in the early pre-prophetic era, where he, you know, at that Hifdul Fudul, which was that, you know, he joined this, it's almost like this organization or that supported peace in the region. As you know, Arabia was very much tribal and tribal wars all the time. And so that Hifdul Fudul, and he said, even if that they offered me or invited me to be part of such a committee for peace, even after prophethood, I would still support this. I would still join this. So he was reflecting back on that pre-prophetic action or, you know, for social justice and peace. And so it's a very prophetic thing to do, to seek justice and peace in the world. And so I think Muslims don't have a problem in joining their brothers and sisters, whether they're believers or non-believers in Australia.
But of course, there's another side to the prophetic tradition that is opposition to immorality. You mentioned Prophet Lut and so on. So there will be times when we're not able to form alliances, if that's what we're doing, with the political left, because we have a perspective which is based on what God has said when it comes to marriage and LGBT, etc. So we're not completely at home with forming alliances with any of these particular groups, because they have their own ideology.
Yeah, of course, on that point, I definitely agree with you. We're not shy away as a Muslim community to define and refine who we are. This is who we are. We will stand with you for human rights of everybody. But we do have our tradition, and that's not to be compromised. And I think that's one of the strengths of the Islamic tradition that can offer that. I think a lot of people today, modern people, are finding attractive about Islam. Sorry, just to cut you off, just want to say on this issue of activism in this sort of social justice area, I find that perhaps what we can learn from Nursi and Iqbal is that you can be involved, because I find that some Sufi, and I don't want to categorize the Muslim world, but some Sufi-inclined groups are quite pacifist in their approach and they ignore social justice as a result of that. And I find that it's not the prophetic. When we come back to the prophetic ethos and the prophetic spirit, I think in this time it calls on each of us to, it evokes that in all of us to come forward, especially at a time where action and, you know, our voices or in whatever form that we may be able to be advocates for peace, advocates for human rights and for justice. And I think this is an important point that I think that we can learn from both Iqbal and Nursi, that they actually are, I would say that they both arrived at similar conclusions, although their methodologies were different.
Mm. There's another issue perhaps we can explore. It seems as though for many that a new era is dawning globally, geopolitically, and socially, and many say we are in need of a new approach and outlook. I mean, what can be added from our context to this? Do you think there is this paradigm shift in some ways globally going on, particularly perhaps amongst the young? Do you detect that in Australia as well?
Absolutely. I do feel that there's a spiritual surgery, there's a social and political surgery happening, and whether there's the hand of the divine, definitely no doubt from the Islamic perspective that I have, for you know, in a long time have experienced a great change and shift at every level possible. And I think that this we are at that epoch. I do feel that humanity is at that epoch where we are going to go through a big revolution and change, and that we're being prepared for it. I mean, events like this are not alien to our past 100, 200 years, unfortunately. We've had a lot of disastrous events, a lot of genocides that have taken place. Here in Australia, there was a wonderful Australian scholar who just passed away about 2 weeks ago, and she mapped out the Australia's map of all the Aboriginal colonies that and tribes that were massacred. So she sort of mapped out the massacres of the Aboriginal people here on the Australian land, island, and particularly in places like Tasmania and so many other places. And when you realise that, when you look back at history and see what's happening, it's horrifying. So I think people are realising that this is not something that we've been sold. We've been cut short. Like, this is not what we were put. We didn't imagine this civilization to be the way that it's operating. And so,
there's extreme disconnect, is there not, between the way our when I say our civilization, I mean the West, of course, presents itself in terms of liberal values, tolerance, human rights, respect for the individual, respecting diversity, all these, dare I say, cliches. And then at the same time, this very same civilization historically has been responsible for the most appalling genocides in the history of the world, whether it be Australia with the genocide of the native peoples in your country, and the Western support, obviously, for the Zionist state in Israel at the moment, and so on and so on. So there's extraordinary paradox or juxtaposition of violence and mass killings with in the minds of people who support liberalism and secularism and modernity. And I've always found that very bizarre. And the temptation is to just say it very cynically, as just a con, as just an ideological kind of pretense to justify crude imperialist or colonialist power. There are other people like Professor Mohammed Fadl, who I interviewed recently from the University of Toronto. He's a Muslim and a lawyer and so on. And he said he has a different take on this. He doesn't deny, of course, any of the atrocities and crimes that have been committed in the name of liberalism. But his answer is to apply real liberalism, you know, actual human rights and tolerance and so on. So he says it's just liberalism hasn't been applied thoroughly enough or consistently enough across the board, if I've understood him correctly. So there is a response of cynicism, rejection, on the other hand, a response of, well, actually, we need still, the liberal project still has legs and we still need to walk with it. And it seems the jury is out for a lot of people on that. I mean, do you have a view? It's a very controversial issue, but do you have a view on that yourself?
Well, that's a wonderful, so that's really interesting about Mohammed Fadl's, Professor Mohammed's approach on liberalism. Yeah. I suppose my response to that would be, I don't think that liberalism as such is problematic. In theory, it looks, you know, and when we look at Iqbal and Nursi, the liberal project seemed plausible to them, that they were, even Nursi, who was a traditionally owned, trained scholar, he supported constitutional reform, even in the Ottoman Empire towards the end. and so many other sort of social and political reforms, like even up to the Young Turk period. But then when they saw that, no, within this project, it doesn't, it's somewhat, I think the experience of Europe is different from the experience of Islam. And I think we're at an epoch in global history where these shared experiences are merging. So the experiences of the West, the liberal West, with what it has to offer, and also Muslims or others, you know, other people from the, you know, global South, as it's put that way, and they're coming forward, and we're now in a dialogue. You know, it's not Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations. I don't believe in that theory, no. But I do think that while I don't think that we should flip something on its legs completely either, but I am for reform from within. So I'm happy to work with whatever works for the sake of humanity. Mm-hmm. We have the UN Declaration of Human Rights, but at the moment it looks like a big international mockery because those, you know, none of the sort of set rules, the international law has been applied.
No, I mean, so, we get the example. I think it's an ongoing debate in the UN at the moment about yet again about giving Palestine official state recognition in the UN. And as always, it's going to be vetoed by one country, the same country, which is the United States. So the international will, which is the global consensus on this, and has been for years, as far as I can see, is routinely being frustrated again and again and again by the world superpower. And then this makes a mockery of the sense of the United Nations, because the UN will can be simply discarded and vetoed over again and again and again forever. And this is, for most people, intolerable. And also the Security Council seems to have this fixed number of, you know, post-colonial powers like Britain and France and so on. But there are no Muslim majority members of the Security Council, I don't think, ever.
Yeah, so quite. I think it's quite problematic. We've seen the failures of the civilization, but I think I don't want to lose. I don't want to end on a hopeless sort of trajectory either. I think that there is. I actually believe that as a collectivity, there is great evidence of unity among the global human population that are right now speaking up for justice. That's just a testament that there's the conscience, especially among the young people. And I find that fascinating. Why young people? So I feel that conscience is still intact. That they haven't been lured by the greed of the dunya, of the world, if you like, at a spiritual and ethical level. That they are young enough and their conscience is still intact and they're actually being guided for the sake of social justice when they are seeing it, as they did in, as we know, in Vietnam and we've had episodes, South Africa and the civil rights movement in America. I think similarly that's happening today. But I'm interested in the, you know, coming back to decolonization. You know, I really enjoyed the discussion you had on decolonization of Islamic studies with Professor Lombard. But I think when I also look at some of the works that I covered in the book, and Iqbal and Nursi's approaches in relation to colonization. You know, I think as Muslims, our approach to colonization in that modern, early modern era, and as a result of having some sort of an inferiority complex to the developments in Europe in science and technology, led to many problems. It created this, you know, complex, really. And because the attitude in Europe was such that, you know, we must, progress means leaving religion behind. Secularism was the answer and the experience that Europe sort of concluded, came to. But, you know, this became quite problematic when Muslims started to adopt this complex. And then we had Muslim scholars who were shy of religiosity. We still have this sort of mentality sometimes in approaches to Islamic studies, but also in religious aspects and practice, including aspects related to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, including Prophet miracles even. So, you know, and in one of the books I cover, chapter 2, like I do a typology of the modern responses in relation to miracles. Iqbal, for example, addresses it. He says that, you know, in one aspect, the Hashemites and coming from the descendant, the prophetic blood or people of the prophet. Yet he says, you know, they were embarrassed of their Islam. But he, Iqbal then sort of focuses on a cultural revival of Islam. He talks about this concept of khudi, a Persian or a Urdu word, which he wants the Muslim, because of course India has been enslaved or, you know, colonized for such a long time. And he really felt, he felt that Muslims needed to, and not just India, large parts of the Muslim world were under colonization in this time. And so he talks about this concept of khudi, selfhood, that we must find. And he tries to give confidence back to the Muslim, like psyche and also psychology and Muslim culture in that way. And that's sort of his way in his poetry, in his prose works and the reconstruction. And really, he really is trying to address this inferiority complex. When we look at Nursi, you know, he's doing it theologically.
Right.
You know, through, if he wants to prove prophethood, if God exists, you know, he talks about rational proofs. You know, he, for example, he says, you know, so many places in his works, but, you know, he, like, logical, he applies logical premises that, you know, if God exists, then, you know, he's going to speak to prophets and et cetera. So many examples in his works that I do discuss in my book that, but he doesn't ignore coloniality or modernity and what it has to offer, but he rather, he's not shy from it. He doesn't also engage with it apologetically either. He knows it's there and he's happy to, and he doesn't have this inferiority complex, but he's happy to include, if you like, and embrace modernity so long as it's, so long as Islam can find its, you know, its own pronouncement. And one of the things that he does, and I think he's an interesting, successful approach, is that the sciences, you know, there's a interesting segment where the youth come to him and say, you know, in Turkish Republic, you know, there's these maktabs, which were secular, and the madrasas. And the madrasas had no science and what have you, so they were just teaching the religious studies, and the maktabs were just teaching the rational sciences, philosophy, history, but and the physical sciences, positive sciences, but no religion. He saw this gap, and that's what he tried to focus on, education. But he really embraced science, and he said to them, you know, yes, your teachers, listen to them. They are not saying, they're not teaching you about Allah, Allah, and you don't listen to them. But he says, listen to what they're saying, because, I got that right. He says, your teachers may not be teaching you Allah, Allah, but listen to them. Listen to what their sciences point to. What they are teaching is saying Allah. So basically he's saying that the sciences are all indeed a manifestation of reflection.
That's what the Quran says, the ayah of creation, signs point towards God's existence.
Exactly. It's like a commentary of that ayah in his works. And it's kind of like also meshing in Ibn Arabi here as well, in terms of everything manifests God's names and attributes. This is like a theme that is weaved into his works. And so he says, you know, medicine, etc., can reflect God's name, or Shafi, etc. So I think this is a unique way of how he flips it and really says, hang on a minute, we are embracing everything. Because we, and I think it's important that Muslims don't shy away from embracing science. As I think in that early period, some scholars were so skeptical because of the colonial, presence, and also Orientalism as well. There was, you know, I love that concept of epistemicide that Professor Long mentioned also. And I think because of all of those reasons, some became overtly defensive, and some approaches, without naming them specifically, but some of the circles, like among our brothers and sisters, the Tablighi Jamaat, for example, became a little bit more conservative in their approach to sciences or embracing of positive science as something good, because they thought it was like sort of dunya-based or earthly-based.
Well, it can. I mean, I agree with your general point, but iterations of science in the West can often be framed in quite materialist frameworks, materialist paradigms. It's not just notorious atheists like Richard Dawkins, but the paradigm itself is quite reductionist and materialist sometimes.
And this is arguably, obviously, is incompatible with a worldview, a framework which views the transcendent as the ultimately real. Of course, the material of the dunya exists, causality exists, the laws of physics exist, but they're not independent of God, because that will be completely wrong. So I think there is a tension, but I think in terms of the practice of science, I mean, doing astrology, astronomy, or physics and chemistry and so on is fine. But I'm just thinking that the more theoretical iterations of it can, in the West, can be at odds with a worldview that is focused on the ultimately on the transcendent and the metaphysical realm as the ultimate reality. And this is where Lombard, who you mentioned several times, because Lombard, you know, mentions the sort of epistemic sovereignty to regain our tradition, which is not anti-science, because Islamic science has had a very honorable, extremely long lineage, goes back 1,000 years or more. It needs to be framed perhaps in a worldview which is not hostile to the fundamental realities of existence.
Mm, I really like the way you frame that, absolutely, because I think, yeah, at fundamentally science, you know, Muslims contributed to the scientific methodology, right? Yeah. So absolutely, I agree with you, but I think the intention behind the knowledge has to be good. And I think the scholars in point do discuss the shortfalling of the system. Just one thing that I think was interesting, one way I think Nursi tries to reconcile this dilemma, he's quite critical of positivist sciences that deny God, you know, and he tries to tackle them head on. He talks about these three faces of the dunya or the world. It's often in Islamic ethical akhlaq literature, spiritual literature, there's this condemnation of the world, so to speak, in the dunya, you know. But he sort of says that there are three faces of the world, and he talks about that. And he says, you know, he tries to give a spiritual angle to the world that we live in. And he says that from the perspective of Deen, it's good because the earth can also manifest, be a realm of manifestation of God's names and attributes, and also a field where we can plant the seeds through our acts of service and work for justice, etc., for the hereafter and charity. So he sort of tries to reconcile because we do need to progress as individuals, as people, and Muslims and communities. But it should be for the sake of, elevating God's name, not the other way around, which I think what you were pointing to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm, yeah, it's very interesting. So just finally then, coming back to your book, as a book, is available now. It's been published, I think, last year. Who is your target audience, your intended readership for this? Is it other academics, or can those of us who are not academics access it? Should we read it and get hold of copies for ourselves, do you think?
Yes, I think although definitely for researchers and academics it would be a relevant book, but I think it's the way it's written, it's definitely accessible to a wider readership. Right. There is a chapter that includes, and it sort of was when I was doing my, you know, working on this research for a while, I was not able to find in the English language a sort of complete overview of Nubuwwah or, you know, prophethood in Islam, you know, how from its origins, how the dialectics developed, sort of covering that Islamic intellectual history and theology and philosophy. So it covers a range, but in one of the chapters, I actually include that. So I think people will find that some chapters like that may be useful for those who are interested in just looking at how Muslim modern scholars have sort of grappled with these issues of colonialism and faith in a secular modern era. I think looking at the Iqbal and Nursi's work and thought, I think they might find that interesting. Their methodology in particular would be interesting. I had some parting words, but I guess if there's no other questions, I might some key things I think that I may have missed in relation to the prophetic topic that I didn't want your audience to miss out on. I mentioned the political revival also, so I won't talk about that, but in addition to that sort of their framing of the Islamic revival in the political arena, there was the decolonization, as I said earlier, as well. There's also one way that Nursi, for example, elaborates, and I find that this is a unique way, that he says there's one way of looking at history is through the role of prophets in history. So looking at history through the lens of the prophets. And he says history is sort of, they can say that there's a prophetic line of how you can look at history, and also the line of philosophy and how you can look at the world through philosophy. And he makes the claim that all major sciences and revolutions in civilization and human history and epoch were championed by prophets. So really what he's doing is technological developments. So he's saying the prophetic miracles were actually the fruit or the seed for these scientific technological developments and scientific developments to be realized. He's not the only one that says that. There's a great Lebanese Syrian scholar from the same period. I've forgotten his name, but he quotes him in his book, who also talks about, he's also an Asharite sort of school. He maintains that same position. This is at a time, contrastingly, when the Azhari scholars like Muhammad Abdul and his likes, and also in India, Sayyid Ahmad Khan, you know, real staunch modernists out there, you know, they were really shy from this topic of miracles, you know, and the miracles, they sort of explain miracles as natural events. But when Nursi's explanation, like other scholars at that time, really spins this on his head in relation to miracles. So no prophetic movements, they actually created civilizations that radically changed the narrative. And recreated confidence in Muslims about prophets and this aspect of prophecy in the Islamic tradition. And of course, this also impacts radically the attitude towards hadith and the movement in the Muslim lands and how this was impacted by colonization. That's a different story. We won't go in there, but probably you've had a lot of discussions on this in relation to how, you know, Orientalists or others deemed hadith studies and matan criticism. And I know someone who did a whole analysis of Imam Tahawi's 15 volumes of hadith and how he actually included matan criticism. So when we look at our epistemology, epistemologically speaking, we have our own critical rich tradition that we can work with that's still relevant and that cannot be denied. There's one other thing that I might add, and so apart from that prophetic history, there's that Wilayat al-Kubra, so spiritual revival. And I think this is also relevant to today because I think post-colonization, you know, if we think about the Sufi tariqas, they were somewhat, we were cut off, you know, from, and yeah, today people would argue, no, we haven't been, and they exist and we have WhatsApp, we can still connect to the Sheikh and the Murid. But they're not the same. And I think one plausible understanding that comes from works, and I think Iqbal has done this through revival of like the Rumi tradition in his poetry, but I feel like Nursi has something unique, and I find this really interesting because he says that we live in a time that we need a prophetic type of spirituality, you know, in terms of spiritual revival. And his emphasis on sunnah, heavily quoting the Indian scholar Ahmed Sirhindi from the 16th century Mughal era, Nursi relies heavily on him. He brings prophethood again to the center with this revival. On his basically in Sufism, tasawwuf, you know, wilaya or sainthood is, you know, defined as categories, and there's different definitions of it. But Nursi says today the way forward, the real development in wilaya or sainthood that a Muslim is able to achieve is through the sunnah, and it's through prophetic duty. Right. The prophecy has ended in Islamic tradition and understanding with Prophet Muhammad, but prophetic duty continues today. So prophetic duty, and what that means is, I think that's something in addition to concepts that we have in our traditions like jihad, which are becoming topical again, and also a concept that I heard from one of the great English scholars that came to Sydney recently, Murabitin, those who are in the frontiers, that's another way. But this whole concept that anybody in their given context can reach a higher sainthood if they adhere to the sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, by adhering to the prophetic duty. What is that prophetic duty? Irshad, or guidance, faith-based revival, which is something what you're doing, Paul, through your educational channel in theology, really bringing us back to our core. Because I think this education and this revival of faith is so very much necessary for Muslims and other people as well, believers, to move forward. So I think I've talked too much. I might just
No. I mean, the subject is endless, and so many facets to it. But the good thing is we have your book, which I will link to in the description below, so we can plunge in or deep dive into these topics in much greater detail, thank goodness. And also, you're very active on social media. I noticed you're very active on Twitter, or X, as it's now called. I'll put your handle, Twitter handle, in the description below, so you can focus your, well, your passion for social justice is very evident on your online presence. So you're very active there too, and that's obviously very commendable. So we might perhaps leave it there, because we could go on for hours and hours and hours. But as I say, people can read your excellent work for themselves, inshallah. I guess it just remains for me to thank you very much, Dr. Ansari, for your time and your eloquence, and you're in your own way, you're a beacon of hope from Australia. So I commend you for that, and just thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your kind words, Paul. Thank you so much. Wonderful to be with you.
Until next
time. Saving money on everything now at Menards. Create fresher, cleaner air with damp-rid products. Control the humidity in your space with a hanging bag moisture absorber. They're great for closets and laundry rooms. Grab a 3-pack on sale through September 8th. Save big on damp-rid moisture absorbers at Menards. America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction according to J.D. Power. Visit jdpower.com for details and menards.com for deals. Save big.